This is special coverage from NPR News. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson at NPR Election Headquarters in Washington, D.C., and we are waiting for President Obama to make his first remarks on the election of Donald Trump. He's going to speak at the White House, and we will bring that to you live.
The sitting president spoke with the future one this morning by phone. Trump's Twitter bio now reads, President-elect of the United States of America. After winning, he tweeted, "We will all come together as never before." And while he used Twitter during the campaign to lash out at opponents, he said this last night after being declared the future president.
To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time.
And this morning, Hillary Clinton spoke for the first time since losing.
Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. And we don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines other things: the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them.
Joining us from Washington right now is Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent. And Mara, so much has happened even just this morning. We've heard from Hillary Clinton. We're waiting on President Obama. Your thoughts on what we're hearing today and what happened last night?
Well, what we're hearing today is the remarks of a gracious loser who conceded and talked about the importance of a peaceful transition of power. It's just a little ironic since Donald Trump never promised to concede if he lost, said he might only accept the results of the election if he won. But she did what all other losers in American presidential elections have done, which is offer their cooperation to the winner and to, talk about the values of democracy. She also said that I thought was interesting. She said the other things that we cherish, the other democratic values, are rule of law, the notion that we're all equal, freedom of expression, and she said we must defend these values. I thought that was a subtle way of saying we stand ready to resist a President Trump should he decide to trample on any of them.
Well, Mara, what do you think, to Jeremy's question, what do you think happened, though? How do we get here? Books are going to be written on this, an historic election. But I'm struck by what historian Michael Beschloff said just a couple of weeks ago. He said, you know, the Trump campaign will go down as one of the worst run organizationally in American history. And yet,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. He didn't do any of the things that traditional candidates do. He didn't have a ground organization. He wasn't disciplined. He didn't prepare for debates. He didn't seem to care about policy. But what he did do is he tapped into a very deep, strong well of grievance and anger. It was really a revolt of the white working class against elites, against globalization, against immigration. That's something that's happening worldwide. He somehow understood, maybe instinctively, that he could ride white identity politics all the way into the White House. I think he was as surprised as anyone that he won. But
isn't it also, though,
that's
Mara,
what happened? Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, isn't another part of this, though, that maybe some Bernie Sanders supporters, African-Americans, some of the left didn't turn out for Hillary Clinton?
There's no doubt that she didn't get her coalition out in the numbers that she needed to. African-American voting for her was down from the Obama elections. And we certainly can assume that a certain number of Bernie Sanders voters did vote for Gary Johnson or Jill Stein, and that certainly hurt her in some states. There's no doubt that she turned out to be a weak candidate. She was a status quo candidate with a lot of baggage, tremendously high negatives, almost as bad as his, running in a change election. This was an election where voters, after 8 years of two terms of a president, generally voters want a change, and they certainly wanted it this time. And what was interesting to me is that 2/3 of people said that Donald Trump didn't have the temperament to be president, but 20% of them voted for him anyway.
Right.
So many voters were willing to take a risk on someone they didn't think was qualified just because they were so angry at the system, felt left behind by globalization or deindustrialization or changing demographics. There was certainly a lot of resentment of diversity and the loss of status for white working class people, particularly men. All of that was part of it.
That's Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent. As we await President Obama's response, he's going to be speaking soon to the American people. His response to the election last night, the historic election of Donald Trump. And it's funny, Mara, you mentioned that even, you know, maybe he was surprised. We're going to be speaking to Trump voters. Some of them were kind of surprised, and some told us it was more of a protest vote, and they're not sure how they feel now that he's won. But, Mara, I want you to stay there. I want to bring in Julian Zelitzer for a second, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton's Woodrow Wilson School at NPR in New York. Julian, you always help us parse these stories. But have you ever seen a week or a time like the last couple of weeks where, you know, Mara was listing some of the things that impacted this race, but then you also had an announcement that Obamacare premiums were going to be going up. You had an FBI director say that there may or may not be an investigation. Have you ever seen a last couple of weeks like that one?
No, these were clearly tumultuous last weeks. And also you have to add to that the ongoing stream of wiki revelations that came out. So it was a very dynamic and unsettling campaign. I must say, though, after looking over what happened last night, I don't think we know yet how much all of that affected the campaign or how much there was stronger underlying support in many of these states for the Trump presidency that might have turned out this way even without some of that back and forth and those unexpected events. Mm-hmm.
Julian, as an historian, as you look at this, there are a lot of people waking up today saying, whoa, this is really different. Donald Trump will be such a different kind of president. People are worried. You know, he's been called unfit for the presidency and dangerous. What do you think as you look at what could be a very different kind of presidency?
Well, it's true. There's many things that are true about that. He has less experience politically than anyone we've seen in office. He doesn't have the military record, for example, of Dwight Eisenhower.
I can just jump in, Julian. I think you told me this morning, is this the first American president who does not have either a military office in his background or a political office in his background?
Yes, that's true. So you can say this is in some ways the least experience in this realm, either militarily or politically. And I think the arguments about temperament, whether you're Republican or Democrat, sometimes he has pretty dramatic swings in public in terms of what he'll say. And so you put that mix into the White House and we don't know exactly what to expect. And don't forget, you now have united Republican government. So some of the checks that naturally might have emerged if government was divided, if Congress, some of it even, had been Democratic, don't exist anymore.
Well, Mara Liasson, NPR national political correspondent, do we have? We have certainly Republicans holding on to the Congress and now the White House, but do we have united Republicans? And what will that mean?
Well, we certainly have one-party government. There's no doubt about that. And there's divisions among the Republicans. There were many Republicans, the highest number we've ever had, who didn't support their party's nominee. But I do think you're going to have Donald Trump signing most of the bills that the Republican Congress sends him. There are a lot of things on his to-do list. Deporting 11 million illegal immigrants, putting out a ban on Muslims, appointing a special prosecutor to put Hillary Clinton in jail, slapping a 45% tariff on Chinese goods, ripping up trade deals. So on some of those, I can see there might be some pushback from some Republicans, too. But, you know, we were all getting ready to write our Republican circular firing squad stories, and I certainly had one ready to go about the kinds of divisions that Donald Trump had exposed. But now we have to write our circular firing squad Democratic versions, not because so much the Democratic Party is divided ideologically the way the Republican Party is. Donald Trump is diametrically opposed to most traditional Republican positions on small government, on trade, on immigration, on America's commitment to NATO, things like that. But I do think you'll see a lot of recriminations inside the Democratic Party. And even though, as Julian said, we don't know if James Comey or WikiLeaks really affected the outcome, I think he'll be one of the targets of the circular firing squad. But then Hillary Clinton herself, I think, will come in for a lot of criticism for being a candidate who just couldn't reassemble the Obama coalition and turned out not to be able to deliver a positive, future-oriented change message.
And if you're just joining us, we are waiting for President Obama to make his first comments after the election of Donald Trump as the 45th president of the United States. NPR's Scott Horsley is with us from the White House. Scott, do we have any sense, first of all, of what the president will say and how he's taking this? Because many people saw Donald Trump's campaign as a repudiation of the Obama presidency.
I think you will hear President Obama echo what Hillary Clinton said about the need for a peaceful and orderly transfer of power. He's spoken oftentimes with gratitude about the way George W. Bush helped him when he took over 8 years ago during what was, of course, a very tumultuous time for the U.S. economy. So he has instructed his staff, and they have been working for some months with both the Clinton campaign and the Trump campaign, that whoever won this election, that there would be an orderly transfer. And President Obama and President-elect Trump are set to meet here at the White House tomorrow to discuss that transition. But make no mistake, this is a stinging blow for Barack Obama. Just days ago, he was out on the campaign trail saying, all the progress we've made over these last 8 years goes out the window if we don't win this election. And that's not just hyperbole. Donald Trump and the GOP Congress do plan to really go after most of the signature accomplishments of President Obama, and with a united Republican government, they can undo them.
Just to tick off some of those. I mean, we've already been hearing surrogates this morning talking about repealing Obamacare, cutting back on gay rights, Roe v. Wade.
I'm not sure gay rights will be high on the list, because Donald Trump is probably the most gay-friendly Republican candidate we've had in a long time, although there's still some antipathy from his fellow party members. But absolutely, Obamacare.
And from his vice presidential candidate,
Mike Pence,
right.
Absolutely, yes. But from the top of the ticket, I think gay rights are probably not in great jeopardy. But certainly Obamacare is on the firing line. The president's orders and the administrative orders that put rules on coal-fired power plants, which are really the centerpiece of the U.S. climate agenda and our contribution to the Paris Climate Accords, those are on the chopping block. Various rulemakings that this administration has done to... Well, Dodd-Frank will be a target legislatively, absolutely. Mm-hmm. There are things that Donald Trump can do on his own within a day of taking office to reverse Obama legacy items, things like the reprieve from deportation for young immigrants who were smuggled in the country as children. That can be reversed on a dime. Lots of things can be done just by the president. Others will take a legislative process. Dodd-Frank will maybe be a little bit more complicated, but you know, the Republican Congress has already passed a repeal of Obamacare that was vetoed by President Obama. They can simply pass that again, and presumably it will not be vetoed. It'll be signed enthusiastically by Donald Trump. They haven't quite figured out what the replacement is going to be. That'll be a bigger challenge. But I think for the 20 million people who have gotten health insurance thanks to Obamacare, that is very much at risk. And President Obama is going to take that very hard, I'm sure.
It looks like we are about 1 minute away from the president's first remarks since the election of Donald Trump. The remarks have been put on the podium there at the White House, so we will be bringing that to you live. But just in the 30 seconds we have before we get to that, Mara, do you expect the Republican Party, now going to be leading in the Senate and the House, to go along with Trump's agenda in his first 100 days, or are they going to be pushback?
Well, that's a really good question. It depends on how fast he wants to move on some of his more divisive, controversial proposals, like Scott listed, getting rid of DACA, building the wall, right. Deporting large numbers of
hey,
illegal
Mara.
Immigrants.
Mara, I'm going to ask you to hold up. Here's the president of the United States.
Votes were tallied. I shot a video that some of you may have seen in which I said to the American people, regardless of which side you were on in the election, regardless of whether your candidate won or lost, the sun would come up in the morning. And that is one bit of prognosticating that actually came true. The sun is up. And I know everybody had a long night. I did as well. I had a chance to talk to President-elect Trump last night, about 3:30 in the morning, I think it was, to congratulate him on winning the election. And I had a chance to invite him to come to the White House tomorrow to talk about making sure that there is a successful transition between our presidencies. Now, it is no secret that the president-elect and I have some pretty significant differences. But remember, 8 years ago, President Bush and I had some pretty significant differences. But President Bush's team could not have been more professional or more gracious in making sure we had a smooth transition so that we could hit the ground running. And one thing you realize quickly in this job is that the presidency and the vice presidency is bigger than any of us. So I have instructed my team to follow the example that President Bush's team set 8 years ago and work as hard as we can to make sure that this is a successful transition for the president-elect. Because we are now all rooting for his success in uniting and leading the country. The peaceful transition of power is one of the hallmarks of our democracy. And over the next few months, we are going to show that to the world. I also had a chance last night to speak with Secretary Clinton, and I just had a chance to hear her remarks. I could not be prouder of her. She has lived an extraordinary life of public service. She was a great First Lady. She was an outstanding senator for the state of New York. And she could not have been a better Secretary of State. I'm proud of her. A lot of Americans look up to her. Her candidacy and nomination was historic and sends a message to our daughters all across the country that they can achieve at the highest levels of politics. And I'm absolutely confident that she and President Clinton will continue to do great work for people here in the United States and all around the world. Now, everybody is sad when their side loses an election. But the day after, we have to remember that we're actually all on one team. This is an intramural scrimmage. We're not Democrats first. We're not Republicans first. We are Americans first. We're patriots first. We all want what's best for this country. That's what I heard in Mr. Trump's remarks last night. That's what I heard when I spoke to him directly. And I was heartened by that. That's what the country needs. A sense of unity, a sense of inclusion, a respect for our institutions, our way of life, rule of law, and a respect for each other. I hope that he maintains that spirit throughout this transition, and I certainly hope that's how his presidency has a chance to begin. I also told my team today to keep their heads up, because the remarkable work that they have done day in, day out, often without a lot of fanfare, often with a lot of attention, work in agencies, work in obscure areas of policy that make government run better and make it more responsive and make it more efficient and make it more service-friendly so that it's actually helping more people. That remarkable work has left the next president with a stronger, better country than the one that existed 8 years ago. So win or lose in this election, that was always our mission. That was our mission from day one. And everyone on my team should be extraordinarily proud of everything that they have done. And so should all the Americans that I've had a chance to meet all across this country, who do the hard work of building on that progress every single day. Teachers in schools, doctors in ER clinic, small businesses putting their all into starting something up, making sure they're treating their employees well. All the important work that's done by moms and dads and families and congregations in every state, the work of perfecting this union. So this was a long and hard-fought campaign. A lot of our fellow Americans are exultant today. A lot of Americans are less so. But that's the nature of campaigns. That's the nature of democracy. It is hard. And sometimes contentious and noisy. It's not always inspiring. But to the young people who got into politics for the first time and may be disappointed by the results, I just want you to know you have to stay encouraged. Don't get cynical. Don't ever think you can't make a difference. As Secretary Clinton said this morning, fighting for what is right is worth it. Sometimes you lose an argument. Sometimes you lose an election. You know, the path that this country has taken has never been a straight line. We zig and zag, and sometimes we move in ways that some people think is forward and others think is moving back. And that's okay. I've lost elections before. Joe hasn't. But, you know. So I've been sort of sharing.
Remember, you beat me badly.
That's the way politics works sometimes. We try really hard to persuade people that we're right. And then people vote. And then if we lose, we learn from our mistakes, we do some reflection, we lick our wounds, we brush ourselves off, we get back in the arena, we go at it, we try even harder the next time. The point, though, is that we all go forward with a presumption of good faith in our fellow citizens. Because that presumption of good faith is essential to a vibrant and functioning democracy. That's how this country has moved forward for 240 years. That's how we've pushed boundaries and promoted freedom around the world. That's how we've expanded the rights of our founding to reach all of our citizens. It's how we have come this far. And that's why I'm confident that this incredible journey that we're on, as Americans, will go on. And I'm looking forward to doing everything that I can to make sure that the next president is successful in that. I've said before, I think of this job as being a relay runner. You take the baton, you run your best race, and hopefully by the time you hand it off, you're a little further ahead. You've made a little progress. And I can say that we've done that, and I want to make sure that handoff is well executed, because ultimately we're all on the same team. All right? Thank you very much, everybody.
That's President Obama speaking live at the White House. This is special coverage from NPR News. Those were his first remarks since the election of Donald Trump as his successor, the 45th president of the United States. I'm Jeremy Hobson, along with Robin Young, and I want to go to Democratic strategist Angela Rye, who is joining us right now, not affiliated with the Clinton campaign. But Angela, your thoughts on the president's remarks?
His remarks were great. Barack Obama continues to demonstrate to us just that motto that Michelle Obama came with as kind of an undercurrent for this election, which is when they go low, we go high. And he definitely did that. I think they were unifying. He talked about Americans being on treating this like an intramural sports, ultimately that we're all on the same team, and talked about what the country needs going forward, which is a sense of unity and respect for each other. And the fact that he was heartened by what Donald Trump said yesterday, I think, is great.
Well, you know what?
Yeah,
we,
Robin.
We also have with us today Mara Liasson, NPR's national political correspondent, Scott Horsley, NPR White House correspondent, Julian Zelitzer, professor of history at Princeton. And, I there's a couple of things I just want to, in the minutes we have, raise. We haven't talked about race or gender. Mara, start with the gender. President Obama said Hillary Clinton is proof to all of our daughters that they can do anything they want. But is that really the takeaway from this election? I'm looking at some comments I've collected, you know, over the months. And there was a man in West Virginia who was a Democrat, but he voted for Trump. And he said, you know, when it comes to security, I'm scared. Other countries, America is more vulnerable because Clinton as a woman would be seen as weak. you know, these are things that we heard over the past few months.
Well, gender played a huge role in this election. Not only was Hillary Clinton running, if she was elected, she would be the first woman. If she had been elected, she would have been the first woman president. But also, Donald Trump ran a tremendously gendered campaign. He talked about that she didn't have the stamina. There was tremendous misogyny among his supporters. The T-shirts that said Trump that, I can't even say the word. Mm-hmm. You know, there was talk. He's the first. His running mate, Mike Pence, over and over and over again talked about Trump's broad shoulders.
Right.
And so there was tremendous gender was always present. In terms of race, I think that the fact that Donald Trump ran, as Paul Ryan actually called him out on once, on a platform of white identity politics. As a matter of fact, Donald Trump got his start on the national scene when he toyed with running for president back in 2011 as the original big birther. And, you know, questioning the legitimacy, the constitutional legitimacy of the first black president of the United
States. Well, and let's not just jump in.
You can't just ignore. Yes.
Right.
So those two things were very present.
Well, and just to say, Van Jones, the African-American commentator and activist, last night said, you know, part of this vote was white lash. That's what he called it.
Yes, I think so. I think there was, look, not all Trump supporters are racist, and they would be the first to tell you that. But the fact is that when you polled Trump supporters, they were more likely than any other voters to say that immigrants hurt America, you know, minorities get extra preference, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I think that it's not the whole story, but white identity politics was certainly part of the Trump appeal.
Well, let's bring in Paris Denard, who's a Republican strategist who's been listening in to the president's remarks, not affiliated with the Trump campaign, or I guess soon to be the Trump presidency, at least not yet. Paris, what are your thoughts on what President Obama just said?
I worked for the president, George W. Bush, in the White House and was there in 2009 for the transition. Mr. Obama was then Senator, President-elect Obama, and we went out of our way, but it was a direct order from President George W. Bush to have a peaceful transition, a wonderful transition, a coordinated transition, to make sure he had everything that he needed to have to bring in his team and have no issues. There were going to be O's taken off the computers like it was when President Clinton left, and there were W's removed from the keyboards and the offices were trashed. None of that was going to happen, and I think he's going to do the same thing for President-elect Trump. He set the right tone for the country, and he set the right tone for this political process. The beauty of America is that we have a peaceful transfer of power, and we all need to be respectful of the fact that Mr. Trump is now the president-elect. He won handedly. He won decisively. And he did it not just with white voters. I don't believe that he had 8% of the black vote from exit polling that I've seen, 29% Latino vote. That's up from what Romney received when people said he would get 0 to 2% and said Latinos would not vote for him. 29% from the polling that I saw did. So
Paris,
across the board, he did very well.
Paris, just to clarify, though, you do know that he lost the popular vote, right? I think that's an important distinction. I respect the Electoral College and how things will play out when they meet, but I do think we would be remiss if we told these viewers that he won the popular vote, because that's not true.
And I think we'd be remiss if we said that Secretary Clinton won a overwhelming amount of the popular vote. I think it's very,
I didn't
very
say
close
that.
Right
you
now.
Just said
right,
it was a decisive victory, and that's not
well,
exactly
when
true.
When you look at the map and the red states that are there.
Absolutely.
It's a decisive victory. A Hillary Clinton campaign staffer, perhaps the African American, said, "I didn't know you all were going to just injure us. You all killed us. You all just totally obliterated us."
Yeah, with that in mind, I mean, Paris and Angela, we've been with you for a long time now, and we've also watched you on panels on national television. How are you each doing today? I mean, you know, Paris, you took a lot of knocks, for your support of Donald Trump. Angela, there was an expectation going in today. Start with you, Angela. How are you doing today?
So this is devastating to me. I think democracy lost. I think that voter suppression and restriction on voting on the Voting Rights Act lost. I think that the GOP leadership really misunderstood its base. And to be fair to Paris, I think he absolutely has said that throughout. I think that the Democrats did, too. I think that there are two parties that have to engage in some autopsy reflection at this point. I do think there's potential room for growth, though, and I am grateful that Paris isn't just a sparring partner, but he's a friend, because I have a ton of questions about what I got wrong. I think that political pundits everywhere, even if we have an opinion or if we came to this objectively, are questioning the many ways in which we misunderstood this electorate. And we certainly, certainly did. I would have never anticipated that white women would vote for Donald Trump at a rate of 52%. In some instances, we could argue that that's against their own interests. So this is shocking to me.
Paris, how are you feeling today, briefly?
Yeah, I just feel this is a good day for the country and for America, because we have a candidate who listened. Not just that, he wasn't just hearing, he listened to the American people and gave them a message of that was inspirational and aspirational, and they responded in kind across the board, and they didn't give in to what I believe were lies and mischaracterizations of who he is as a man and who he is as a father and who he is as a business leader. And I think as we move forward, pundits and pollsters and the political class are going to have to rethink how they judge the American people outside of Washington, D.C., because clearly they got it wrong. And I thought Mr. Trump was going to win. I didn't know the victory was going to be this large. That's pretty amazing.
Ms. Paris Denard and Angela Rye are Republican and Democrat strategist, and then we also have on the line Mara Liasson, NPR's national political correspondent, Scott Horsley, NPR's White House correspondent. We know you guys have to get back to the reporting that you do, but just a quick closing thought from each of you before we let you go. Mara?
I think that the big question in the days ahead is, can Donald Trump follow through on his remarks last night about wanting to unify the country after running what many people, including Republicans, called a very divisive, polarizing campaign that was built on grievance. And we do know that large numbers of voters, I saw a poll that said 90% of the supporters of both Clinton and Trump said that they couldn't accept the other candidate if they were president. Yeah. So I think the challenge is very, very large. And this was a race that really cleaved the country on race and gender and education, which is now the proxy for class. And I think the big question now is, can those divisions be overcome?
Yeah, Scott?
You know, Barack Obama's used that relay race metaphor a lot of times. He clearly wanted to pass that baton off to Hillary Clinton, who would have kept moving in the same direction. Instead, he's going to try to have a smooth handoff to Donald Trump, who will then run in many ways in the opposite direction. But he was certainly committed to a smooth transition. And as he said, for Democrats, we learn from our mistakes. We do some reflection. We lick our wounds. And we try even harder the next time.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley joining us from the White House, where we just heard from President Obama, his first remarks since the election of Donald Trump. We've also been speaking with Mara Liasson, NPR political correspondent, Julian Zelizer, a historian at Princeton, Angela Rye, a Democratic strategist, Paris Denard, Republican strategist, a whole host of people here just taking in the news from last night, the surprise news that Donald Trump has been elected. He will have a Republican House and a Republican Senate. Joining us now is Senator Roger Wicker, Republican from Mississippi and member of the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Senator Wicker, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be with you.
And a lot of Americans asking a lot of questions about what this means today. What do you expect Donald Trump's first order of business to be when he becomes president in January?
I think two things. I do think he'll put forward a plan to repeal and replace Obamacare and put something in place that doesn't involve these skyrocketing premiums, that uses market principles to keep down medical costs. And then I think we'll see a reversal of a lot of what I've termed executive overreach. President Obama has done so many regulations. When we've challenged him in court, it's taken a long time, but almost always the courts have agreed with us. And so I think there'll be a lot less effort to legislate through the regulatory agencies and a lot more effort to make changes through legislation the way it's been done.
Do you expect the Iran nuclear deal to be one of the executive actions that a president-elect Trump will undo in his first day or few days?
Well, let me say, I signed a letter making it clear to the world that this didn't have the force of a treaty because it wasn't being treated as such, and that therefore it's only so good as the signatories to the agreement. So what the president will decide to do, I think, remains to be seen. But but I think we will be vindicated by saying this. It's going to be permanent and it's going to be binding on successors of President Obama. It should have been done in a way that needed the ratification of the Senate.
What do you say to Latinos in this country, and actually especially undocumented immigrants in this country, who are very worried today about what this election of Donald Trump means for them?
Well, you know, I think President Obama and Secretary Johnson have made it clear they've deported more illegal immigrants than any administration in history. So I really don't think that Hispanics have anything in particular to be worried about any more so than before. I do think that persons who are here illegally are subject to deportation, but that's certainly been the case aggressively from this Obama administration. So I think Latinos, minorities, I think there is an opportunity for a Donald Trump to make good on what he said, that the sort of welfare state and the low expectation of joining the middle class and the good life can be reversed for members of the minority. So this actually may turn out to be a godsend for minorities. I certainly hope so.
That is Senator Roger Wicker, Republican senator from Mississippi. Senator, thanks so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
We want to take a look now at the evangelical vote. Exit polls showed that white evangelical voters voted in high numbers for Donald Trump, 81% to 16%, again, according to those exit polls. So let's bring in Dr. Robert Jeffress. He's the senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, and a vocal Trump supporter for months. So, Dr. Jeffress, I'm presuming this is a good day for you.
It's a very good day.
what were you thinking as the night went on, and what's your reaction to what's happened?
You know, it was interesting. I was with President-elect Trump and Melania yesterday afternoon in his office, and he asked me, Robert, how do you feel like the evangelical vote is going to turn out? And I said, it's going to be very strong. Frankly, I had no idea it was going to be this strong. And I think really the reason it has been as strong, and I said this to Mr. Trump, is what happened in that last debate. During that last debate, he made the strongest commitment to a conservative Supreme Court, and he articulated the strongest pro-life defense of any Republican presidential nominee in history. And I include in that Romney, McCain, either of the Bushes, or even Reagan himself. And I think that resonated with a lot of evangelicals.
Well, what about the comments? I mean, you're well aware of them. That he grabs women by the genitalia, that he tried to bed a married woman, not just a couple there. You know, well, first of all, you know, many people who are of faith, who are Christian or other faiths, said that's unacceptable. And people who are not of any faith say that's unacceptable. Why not for an evangelical?
Right. Well, first of all, you know, I certainly don't condone everything Mr. Trump has said or done in his life. I don't condone everything I've said or done in my life. But I think here's the difference. You know, when evangelicals overwhelmingly voted for Ronald Reagan, he was a known womanizer in Hollywood. He would become the first divorced president in history, yet they chose him over a once married, faithful Baptist Sunday school teacher named Jimmy Carter. By doing that, they weren't endorsing womanizing. They weren't endorsing divorce. They were endorsing Reagan's policies. And I think that's what you have here. And people say, well, yeah, but Reagan, it wasn't as bad as Trump. You know, as a Christian, we don't think God grades sin. We're all sinners. We're all in need of a Savior. And that's not really what this is about.
Right. But we're not talking about womanizing. Just to be clear, we're talking about charges of sexual assault, someone who on tape at least sounded like a predator. And he might have to go to court to it's scheduled in December to face an allegation of rape from a teenager.
But I think the operative word there is allegation. It's not been proven yet. And people could point out and say, well, what role did Hillary Clinton say in enabling her husband to perform alleged attacks on women as well. I don't think people wanted to get into that. I think on either side, they're looking at the issues, and that's what counts.
Oh, that's Dr. Robert Jeffress, senior pastor at First Baptist Church in Dallas, Texas, a vocal Trump supporter, and a happy one today. Dr. Jeffress, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to bring back in Julian Zelitzer, the historian at Princeton and our guide always on these election days. But just drop in on that for a second, Julian. You know, this huge swath of the electorate that many people were perplexed about voting for Donald Trump. Have you seen this in history? Can you compare this to another time?
Well, it's the case that polarization and partisanship is very strong right now. And there was a lot of talk since Donald Trump's nomination that somehow all these groups would peel away, and they didn't. And there's different reasons, different factions of the Republican Party came home. But I don't think we should underestimate the power of polarization. It's also true that, you know, parties are often coalitions of differing factions. So in the 60s, you had Southern Democrats and Northern Democrats in an alliance, even though they often disagreed on things. Ronald Reagan himself brought together groups that were often at odds, like Reagan Democrats and business leaders. So this is the case that not everyone is always in agreement, although I think many people do feel that there are some fundamental contradictions between some of the things that Donald Trump has said and some of the allegations, but more than just the allegations, and some of the beliefs of religious Americans. And I think that's something he will have to grapple with now that he's their leader.
Julian, a lot of people have compared what just happened in the United States to the Brexit vote, where Britain voted to leave the European Union. It surprised a lot of people. It didn't exactly match up with what the polls had been saying. Do you see a comparison between those two things?
I think the issues are very different. You know, first of all, the Brexit polls were closer than what we saw last night, where everyone got it wrong. But I do think this is going to raise a lot of questions about polling. This is true. Dewey beats Truman on steroids in terms of how wrong the prognosticators were, how off the polls were. This was a very significant mistake. And I think there's going to be a lot of discussion in that industry, in the world of politics, of how they missed so much, frankly. And I don't know the answers, but I think that's the similarity.
We just got about a minute here before the break, Julian, but I was actually also hearing other analysts today say that, in fact, it wasn't that far off, because we forget. We kept talking about 4 points, and the margin of error is a lot wider than it used to be. So it actually has been tighter. We just didn't somehow hear it that way.
Well, it's been a tight election, especially after the summer. But she was consistently said to be in the lead, according to all the aggregation of polls. So we knew it was going to be tight. We knew it was going to be close. But it looked like a lot of these states, especially the safe states, were going her way,
well,
and they didn't.
And she never went to Wisconsin once, and a lot of criticism there. Yeah.
For sure.
That's historian Julian Zelitzer from Princeton, who's been joining us this hour as we take stock of what we know about the election of Donald Trump and more. Julian, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to bring in here now political analyst Paris Denard, Republican strategist not working for the Trump campaign, and Angela Rye, Democratic strategist who is not working for the Clinton campaign. Angela, one of the stories of this election seems to be not so much the turnout for Donald Trump, but the lack of turnout for the Democrats, and overall the turnout the lowest since 2000. What happened to a lot of parts of the Democratic base?
Well, I think this has really been asked and answered quite a bit. We know that they were the most polarizing candidates that we've seen in some time. We know that folks who turned out to vote for Trump could have just been voting against Hillary and vice versa. A number that's staggering to me today is more than 231 million eligible voters in this country, and only 46.9% of those did not vote. Mm-hmm. That means there's a substantial class of eligible people in this country who have not voted for their own representation. And that, to me, regardless of party affiliation, is staggering.
Well, how much of that was the candidate, Angela? And we've talked about this. She was said to be so flawed. But on the other hand, I have to point out, we were talking about religion, Jeremy, just a few minutes ago, and its role in the race. She has been demonized by some people. I actually know anecdotally of people in Washington, D.C., when I worked there in the 90s, who actually thought, I mean, this was not a metaphor, they thought Hillary Clinton was Satan. You know, pick up on that. How much was it this person, you know, either vilified or flawed?
Or how much of it has to do with the fact that she's a woman? You did just talk to, and you just mentioned, frankly, the religious right.
Yeah.
82% of evangelicals could not support Hillary Clinton and did not support Hillary Clinton. And I think that says, that speaks volumes. This is a swath of voters who I talked about, at least on Twitter. They can't see a woman being the head of a household. They can't see the woman, a woman being a head of a church without it being a co-pastor or in a pastoring role with their husbands. And they definitely cannot see a woman being the head of the nation. And I think that's something we really have to talk about, whether that's blatant sexism or not. What we do know is that white women voted for Donald Trump. He won the majority of white women votes.
Mm-hmm. Paris Denard, a Republican strategist, let me bring you in. Was last night a surprise for you? Because it seems now, looking back on some of the things that the Trump campaign had been saying, that they knew something that everyone else did not know about who was going to turn out, especially in some of the states in the upper Midwest and Pennsylvania. But were you surprised by the result when it came, when it happened?
I did not think that at this time, when I'd be talking to my friends here on Here and Now, that I would be saying that Mr. Trump got more than, received more than 270, 270, 270, 270, 270, 280 in terms of the Electoral College. I thought it was going to be much, much tighter and closer. I thought that we would do well and win, but I didn't anticipate it to be, in my opinion, decisive. And so I do believe that, well, let me actually answer it this way. I was not surprised by the fact that the media and many in the pundit class got wrong, once again, the mood of the country and the responsiveness to Mr. Trump's message. I'm on the streets and in cabs and Ubers and all these things all the time, and just walking around, and more people, the people that came up to me talking about they were supporting Mr. Trump and talking about how they appreciated hearing me on Here and Now and hearing me on NPR and watching me on television, they were African-Americans. Mm-hmm. They were young African-Americans. They were older African-Americans, but they were all African-American. And it's an amazing moment to me to sit there and say, the media is not picking up on this. Pollsters aren't picking up on this.
Well, you know, Paris, that may be, but there are other African Americans. You're well aware of this. There have been protests already in Los Angeles, in Oregon, but also, you know, people know of young African Americans, and not just African Americans, people of color, who think that because they're Muslim, they're going to be banned or attacked. Who think that because they're brown, they're going to be deported. Who think that because they're black, that something's going to happen to them. How, what do you do to heal that feeling? Or the party,
I think Secretary Clinton set the right tone today talking about unity. I thought the president set the right tone talking about unity and talking about wanting to work with Mr. Trump to make sure he's an effective president. I think those were good steps. And I think Mr. Trump is going to talk directly to the American people in specific groups and talk about how he's going to make America great again. He has a New Deal plan that he says for African Americans on his website. He has a first 100-day plan that he put out there. And the other thing that's inspirational is the fact that there's young people like Eric Rowe, who is a millennial in Pennsylvania, who won a state house seat. There's a young African-American in Florida, who's a Republican, who won his seat. So they're across the board. There are people that are responding to Mr. Trump, but also down ballot. People were saying and giving these new millennials and these new voices in the Republican Party a chance. And so it's not just going to be Mr. Trump. It's going to be the House. It's going to be the Senate. It's going to be people like me. And it's going to be these new generation of people who came up under Mr. Trump.
Just got a couple seconds here, guys. Yeah, just a couple seconds here, guys.
Way to filibuster Paris.
Filibuster by Paris. Paris Denard, Republican strategist, and Angela Rye, Democratic strategist, our great friends here.
You'll
at
be
here
back.
Now.
Yeah.
You'll be
We're
back. Thank you so much to both
together.
Of you.
Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.